We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. Your hosts are Michael McNamara and me, Ryan Schwan. It's all Pelicans, all the time.
Welcome to the show. We are a few days behind because, of course, I had my butt in sunny Minneapolis, completely unable to record a podcast with my friend Michael McNamara, when the huge, huge news broke that the New Orleans Pelicans signed Seth Curry to a summer league deal. Michael, earth-shaking?
I say we go minimum 90 to 100 minutes on the topic and that topic alone. I mean, he was in the Smoothie King Center for Game 3, a lot of action shots of him, you know, in the crowd with his dad. This is history. You know, what I honestly thought the second I heard this news was I started thinking of like some Game of Thrones marrying houses. They have the brother of our point guard. We have the brother of theirs. Like it seems like the two houses are being married together in order to form some kind of strange ultimate power in the Western Conference.
As long as we're not the Starks, I think everything should turn out all right.
Yeah, I just want to know who's on the wall. Like it's got to be the Lakers, right?
Yeah. So let's actually talk what really matters. So I'm sure everybody has heard the news. Monty Williams, coach for the New Orleans Pelicans for 5 seasons, is it? 5? Is gone. He's been let go by the team. A lot of people were extremely surprised by this. Were you surprised by it, Michael? Did you see it coming?
I mean, no, I didn't see it coming. And I even went back today. I don't do this much, but I actually went back this morning in preparation for today and listened to our last podcast. And I think, you know, you and I both questioned Monty, and especially you gave 80% of the blame for Game 3 to Monty Williams. And, you know, but we both had said that we expected him back. We both expected a pretty quiet offseason. And then, boom, just seemingly out of nowhere, it was going up on a Tuesday, Monty Williams loses his job. So in this podcast, I kind of want to take it slow because it's a huge thing to digest. And we've had a couple of days now and there's a lot of things to touch on, you know, and I want to talk about I'll try to clarify as much as possible the things we know versus the things that we're speculating on. This is pure speculation, at least on my end, and I wonder where you stand. What do you think happened? What do you think the timeline was for this decision? Because it seemed like only a couple of weeks ago, you know, that this was not happening. We got a letter from Benson in which, you know, he praised Monty, you know, the Wojnarowski report that it was playoffs or be fired, and then obviously they made the playoffs. When do you think this decision was made, and your pure speculation, why?
I actually believe the decision was made shortly before the firing happened. And why? I mean, people have this idea that when organizations say things like, we'll let the season end, we'll evaluate everything, and then we'll decide, that's not really true, that people have made up their minds and they're just waiting for the chance to pull the trigger. I really honestly think that they went back, they evaluated what they saw improving on the team, what they didn't see improving on the team. Then they looked around at who might be available on the market, and they decided, what's better for us, go for something that's out there or keep Monty around? And I wouldn't be surprised at all if they had a couple conversations with some major pieces on the team just to feel them out. Like, if he leaves, would that make Anthony Davis extremely pissed off? Just to get a really quick feel. And then they had decided that there's a better option out there. And I mean, I can't sit here and say they were like, Tom Thibodeau will be available, so therefore we must make this move. But I think they just decided, like you did, maybe, I don't know, 4 months ago, which was, he's not the answer. He's not the guy who's going to take us all the way. So let's see if we can find someone who can.
And what things do you think were the biggest part, again, pure speculation, and their decision-making of how they came to that decision that he isn't, you know, that cog, he isn't everything that the team needs? I mean, you say that you think they went back and evaluated everything. I completely agree. You know, what do you think? Del Dem said many times that it was an entire, you know, franchise decision. Imagine them sitting in that room. What are the things where they go, you know what? Monty just isn't this. He isn't that. Here's evidence from the season and the playoffs. I don't think he's the long-term guy. Let's look elsewhere. What do you think those things were that they hit on in those meetings?
I think it's going to be one thing and one thing only. Up until this season, Monty could say things like, my defense team's defense sucks because I don't have the defensive personnel to play the kind of defense I want to play. And this season they went out and got a Sheik. They brought in Pondexter. They brought in Cole. And as much as we sit here and say things like, after the All-Star break, the Pelicans' defense was better. It was more like 16th or 17th in the league. 16th or 17th in the league is nothing to be excited about, especially when your team just went out and brought you the guys you said were going to make you be able to be a championship contending team, like an actual defensive team that can get stops when it matters. And that's not what we saw. Like, you can say the 16 is an improvement, but 16 is still worse than average. And that's not getting you anywhere. The only team that's got that kind of defense that's in the playoffs right now is the Clippers. And the Clippers also have the best offense in the league. So when your coach says, this is what I need to be elite, you get him what you feel he needs to be elite, and he produces average, there's your tipping point.
Let me ask you this. Obviously, we can't know, but Pelicans hold on to win game 3, maybe win another one, lose to the Warriors in 6. You think Monty is still fired?
Yes.
You think that, I mean, 100%?
Absolutely. Even if, like, they go down to the last shot in game 7, and lose, like, in dramatic, amazing. I think the only thing that could have saved him is if suddenly he turned this team's defense into something that was closing down a powerhouse like the Golden State Warriors, kind of like the Memphis did to them for a couple games. He has to present like that kind of results, because I really firmly believe that Ashik is not what Dell Demps wanted. Dell Demps did not want to build a team with a classic center. I mean, he's already traded out classic centers, but he got what Monty asked. And so this Ashik thing, I think, is really stiffly tied to how Monty, his results were and what he ended, why he ended up getting fired. I think he was tied to that kind of idea. Like, Dell's finally like, all right, we'll get you exactly what you're asking for and we'll see what happens.
Interesting. So, I mean, I guess the next thing was, what seemed really interesting to me is how it seemed like the Twitterverse, the message board group, the people on our website almost completely flipped, and all of a sudden Monty had, you know, kind of the sympathy of everybody. I mean, you got the video of him on his porch talking about how he was kind of blindsided. We heard later from Dell in the press conference that it was Loomis who fired him that morning. We had the Wojnarowski article, which, you know, I'd like to talk about later, of basically Dell winning a quote unquote power play and forcing Monty out. How do you think about the way that it was handled, the timing of it, the you know, Monty being caught off guard, the fact that Loomis fired him and Dell hadn't even talked to him before the press conference that day, let alone at the time he was fired? How do you think about the handling of the entire situation?
So I don't know how much I care whether it was Loomis or Dell who fired him. I mean, if I was at my work and my director called me in, or my VP above my director called me in and said, you're packed, here's, you know, get out of here, what does it matter? Like, I don't understand that upset. Like, Dell has to do his dirty work in firing the guy. I mean, it's, you know, if Loomis is 100% behind the firing, then why does it matter if Loomis or Dell fires him? I don't have any sort of like, oh, this is an indication that Dell isn't in control. There's some machinations going on. But, you know, as for, you know, how I feel about the timing, isn't this the best time? Like, before any other team has really struck on the market for coaches, you basically make everybody know that, hey, the most amazing coaching job you could want in the NBA, coaching Anthony Davis, is now available, before any coach has made really any sort of decision to go somewhere else. Isn't that exactly what we want? So why should, what time was a good time to get rid of him? If 3 weeks from now, is that a better time? Is suddenly, because now the playoffs are over, it's nicer to Monty? Like, they made the decision after evaluating everything and they fired him. And there isn't any sort of like evil plot or meanness there. He was being fired, and whether he was being fired now or later, it doesn't really matter. And this is the prime time if you're going to start a coaching search to get that done. I mean, would you prefer that the day after the playoffs they came in and said later? I mean, honestly, I think that would be even worse, because there was the good feeling in the community that, yeah, the Pelicans didn't win a single game against the Golden State Warriors, but at least they felt good about kind of the end of the season. So let that set in a little bit and then get rid of Monty.
Yeah, I guess the only weird thing to me is the letter from Benson.
Yeah.
And like, you could probably say that it was crafted and, you know, Benson signed off on it. I don't know how much he had to do with it. You know, but you got to think all the branches of the team are working together, and you're right. If they knew at that time that Monty was going to be fired, I don't think that letter gets put out there. So to me, it's just a kind of weird thing. Is, you know, it's really interesting for me to think about what happened in those, you know, days. I think the problem that people have with Loomis doing the firing, with, again, Dell not speaking to Monty Williams for, I mean, there was, according to what I've heard from people, Monty was told pretty early in that morning that he was fired. And then, you know, so Loomis does it. Dell's press conference is about 3-4 hours later. These two guys that have worked together, Dell said time and time again that there was no friction, that they had a difference of opinion from time to time, but that's natural. But, you know, the fact that he never talked to him, you know, even after Loomis made the call, that was, you know, a little odd to me. Monty's people, and don't let anybody make you think it was anybody different. It was Monty's agent who leaked the story to Woj, talking about how it was a power struggle. Like, I don't know. That was just the slightly odd thing for me. But, I think that you're right in the fact that it was done at this time. I mean, Billy Donovan's the only coach that's been hired. The Thibodeau rumors are out there, and the Bulls were still in the playoffs. So, you know, theoretically, if he's a target, you would want to create a vacancy before they're eliminated and he starts talking to other people. So, you know, I get it too. I didn't really have many problems with it. I just think the problem was that we heard Monty talk over and over lately about how he reported to Loomis. And then now you have this, and it just makes Dell look like he has absolutely no power over this situation. And it's just not the way that I think normal franchises operate. So it's something that makes you a little worried. The good news is that Mickey Loomis has come out this week and said that he wants to get the foundation in place that is similar to how other franchises do it, where the coach now reports to the GM and Loomis kind of takes a step back. So it's something I've been calling for a while now. And if everything goes right and Dell finds his guy, we could have a normal coaching structure. The only other thing I want to bring up, well, there's two things from the press conference. Dell basically addressed the Dumars rumors, said that he was told by Mickey that there was absolutely no truth to it. Again, it looks like something that Dumars himself is just leaking to different reporters, you know, just to get his name out there. I totally believe that there's no truth to it. And then the other thing I was curious about is, and something we'll probably talk about a lot tonight, is how this all affects AD. Dell Dem said that he called AD shortly after, you know, the decision was made that Monty would be let go. Again, pure speculation. How do you think that conversation went?
It's got to be pure speculation. I honestly believe that I think that if Anthony Davis had, I actually don't even know the order. Like, I'm fairly certain that they probably gauged Anthony Davis on how he would feel about this if it happened before they made the move. I mean, I would be almost shocked if you didn't do that, especially considering his contract situation, where they're going to be putting, as soon as they can, that monster 140 whatever million dollar deal on Anthony Davis's table to sign, that you wouldn't at least say, hey, this could be a possibility, would you flip out if this happened? But, you know, there's a lot made that, you know, Anthony Davis and Monty, you know, they love each other, and, you know, he's the only coach he ever had, and blah, 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 like that. But, you know, the reality is, if you're in that situation, you're not best friends with your coach ever. That's just never going to be the case. No coach is ever best friends with one of his players. So what generally is going to happen is he goes, you're going to think, hey, man, that sucks, and then you're going to see what happens. Now, if they bring in a schmuck, then Anthony Davis is going to be rightfully pissed off at some point this season, which is something everybody should be worried about. So if they go out and they, you know, trade a second round pick to the Lakers to bring Byron Scott back, we should all probably just, you know, go buy a Wakizashi and slit our bellies open right now.
Man, last podcast, you're blowing up clubs. Now you're slitting stomachs. what's going on in the personal life? Do we need to talk? I agree. There's, I think that Anthony Davis has a ton of respect for Monty Williams. They'll always, you know, be a part of each other's lives, talk, you know, mm-hmm. It was similar to Byron Scott and Chris Paul, but, you know, Steph Curry was far more upset, seemingly, when Mark Jackson was let go last year. Bring in Steve Kerr and a great staff, they're winning. I don't think anybody would come close to calling Steph Curry, you know, discontent at this point. So it's, you know, it's really about the next steps going forward. I don't think that, you know, and it's weird now to look back on Anthony Davis's end of season interview when this subject was broached. And, you know, he said that him and Monty had talked about one day that, you know, Monty will probably be fired and it's business. And, you know, it's hard not to wonder if maybe there had already been some whispers to Anthony at that point. So I think it's an interesting situation. I think, you know, we'll obviously talk about whether or not this will make it more or less likely or, you know, exactly the same that Anthony Davis signs that contract in the summer, but I guess moving on from how it all went down, now I just kind of want to talk about what happens now. And my first question for you is, when looking at a new head coach, I think there's a lot of things that you could, that you could basically say that you want. Give me your A1 top priority for this next coach. What does he need to have? What does he need to satisfy? You know, anything that you think of. What is the top priority for you if you were heading up this head coaching search?
All right, so you want my top priority and not what I feel Dell and the team's top priority, maybe.
Yeah, give me both.
Because those are two different things in my
world. All right, give me both then.
So my top priority, I want a defensive coach. Like, I know that's not sexy, and I know that there's like this idea that if you bring in a defensive-minded coach, that offense is going to be a secondary thing. They're not going to really think about it, and this offense is sexy. But again, I just keep coming back to the exact same thing, that this team's offense was pretty damn good this year, just in general. And if you can bring in a coach who instills a defense that's really good, this team could run off the misses. They could generate a few more steals. They could just have more rebounds and more ability to attack back at the other team. And that's going to improve. If that improves their offense by 2 points per 100 possessions, they're a top five offense. And defense does generate offense pretty frequently, and the best kind of offense, because it's always, you know, going back in the teeth of a not set defense. So I want a guy who's just going to focus on the defensive end, figure out how best to use this personnel, whether it doesn't have to be a traditional defensive schema for me. Like, if you look at what the Golden State Warriors have, sure, they have Andrew Bogut in the middle, but frequently he plays half the game. And they have a non-traditional defense that they just brought in the kind of guys who can do a aggressive switching scheme and fade into the paint when they need to and understand what they're doing. And that's not a traditional defense. It's not I need a traditional center who will guard the paint and stop guys from scoring. So I want a guy who has a very fixed, good defensive philosophy, but can have one that is a modern defense against a Golden State style attack, or really, I mean, that's a San Antonio Spurs style attack, a ball movement kind of assault, which is becoming more and more prevalent in the league. What I feel the team might be looking at, I actually think that they're going to be looking at a coach. And this is something that I kind of wanted to mention earlier when we were talking about this and the structure of who reports to whom. I don't know how many people remember this. Dell wasn't hired and he picked Monty. Monty was hired and then was part of the process that selected Dell. And so the structure was built at that point where Monty was already reporting directly to the team president at the time, was the NBA. And then Dell came in and he was basically reporting to the same dude. So Dell finally gets to pick his own guy. I think Dell will be looking for a guy who has the exact same offensive philosophies that he does. And when anybody talks to Dell and what he's looking at building and what he wants to construct, defense is not the words that come out of his mouth. He talks about guys who can break down offenses, multiple penetrators who can drive and kick and break the defense of the other team and create a good offense that you know, is continually making the other team shift. So I think he's going to be looking for that, the guy who will take the personnel, which he feels he's put together, which are guys who can crack defenses, and see if he can finally put together that kind of offense. I don't think defense is going to be his top priorities.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you on your second point, and I'm glad that we're going to get to go into this process disagreeing about your first. I think not only is that what Dell will do, but that would be what I would do too. And, you know, I say the same thing as you. It doesn't mean that I would, you know, forego the defense. I personally think that if I had to find a great offensive assistant or a great defensive assistant, I think it'd be much easier for me to find a great defensive assistant. I think that, you know, I a guy like that could come in, you know, really bring the offense to a new level. And I mean, we could talk about offensive rating and we could give a couple of stats here and there. I still don't think that this was a great offense, or better yet, the offense that it could and should be. I mean, the fact that the pace has been what it has been the last couple of years, there's no excuse for that whatsoever. You know, the guard play, I think.
Well, wait, let's stop that right there for a second. So this has been something that actually has bothered me a little bit ever since the days of Chris Paul. People have always said that the Pelicans need to pick up the pace, or the Hornets need to pick up the pace. In the days of Chris Paul, it was because Chris Paul is an elite point guard, therefore they should pick up the pace and they should be able to attack on the move. But I cannot remember a team ever that I've watched from New Orleans or Charlotte that had a high athletic quotient, I guess I should say. Like, a lot of guys who are built to run and are good at running. Like, when you look at Drew Holiday, or you look at Eric Gordon, or you look at Tyreek Evans, do any of those guys scream really good in the open floor and running guards? Which is, in my opinion, the number one thing you have to have is a guy who's good in the open floor, who's going to have the ball in his hands, or actually more than one. Do you think that you could turn those guys into that? Do you think they are that? Like, I don't feel that way. Like, Tyreek Evans in the open floor terrifies me because he's going to make some bad decisions at times. And Eric Gordon, I don't think there's a word to describe, like, my terror. Like, it's beyond terror. It's just death. And, you know, maybe Drew Holiday is a little bit better, but I don't remember any amazing highlights where Drew Holiday was continuously attacking in transition, and maybe he's not being directed to, but I don't buy the whole this team was built to be a fast-paced team and therefore Monty was a moron not to push him. He's got one dude, Anthony Davis, who's an amazing athlete who gets up and down the floor like crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, Monty has never
that's true.
Played with it, and even coming from Portland, pace was not a priority there. And as far as our current roster, I mean, again, another thing I'm sure we'll continue to talk about. I think now, you know, who's to say that you plan for anything other than Anthony Davis. I mean, now that you have a new coach, isn't it basically this is Anthony Davis's team and some of these guys might be around him, some won't, but to find a coach and strictly grade him on what he might do with this current roster when I don't know. I mean, isn't it possible? I mean, don't you think it is possible that at least four of the other five supporting pieces could be gone within 16 months?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, basically you're building a team around Anthony Davis's strengths. And for me, I think it would be the ultimate waste if he plays the first 7-8 years of his career at a bottom 10 pace. So,
okay.
You know, I mean, whatever. I don't think that's the only thing, but to me, you know, I think it's a big priority, and pace just doesn't mean fast breaking. I mean, I don't think that the Spurs have a roster that, you know, you would say, oh, that's going to be a team that is going to play at a fast pace. It's not about just fast breaking. It's about getting into an offense early. It's about, you know, trusting your guards a little bit more and then developing their IQ. So I don't know. I agree with you that that's what Dell would do, is going to do. And, you know, I think I would go along those lines with them. So, I mean, with all that said, they're going to go into this process, or they're already in it now. Plus, they have this huge summer coming out when they're going to put the contract down for Anthony Davis. How involved would you make AD in this process? You know, how would you do this search with him in mind? What would be kind of your parameters for that?
How involved with him? I wouldn't make him involved at all. Quite honestly, I don't think he needs to be part of the coaching search. Now, when I've narrowed it down to just a few candidates, I probably would inform him we're looking at these two or three guys. But even then, I wouldn't even solicit what he felt about it. Honestly, like that's there is a difference between gauging a guy when you're breaking something he's familiar with and giving them the keys to the car. And at this point, I don't think Anthony Davis has the experience in the league to be able to make those kind of calls intelligently. Like he's still learning the way of playing basketball, and he feels pretty young in that respect. And I would not want him to be like talking to him and really think that he's had time to meet all the different coaches and understand all the different motivations and be able to intelligently say that this is the best options for me, because he's not dealing with those kind of ambitions and people very often. So that's my take, at least, on whether they should have Anthony Davis involved. You agree or disagree? You think that they should be more involving him more in a search, like asking him for what do you think? Who do you think we should look at, kind of things?
No. Who do you think we should look at? No. But what type of style would you like to play, Anthony?
Okay.
What do you like doing on the defensive end? What do you not like doing? Because, like, you look at a coach like, you know, we would talk about Messina from the Spurs. He's going to want, I mean, based on he had a manifesto of his philosophies that I thought was incredibly interesting. He's going to want to put Anthony Davis in the post and want to work through him that way. Anthony Davis has said he wants to work on his ball handling and three-point shot this summer. So you don't consult Anthony Davis and you bring him in, and then all of a sudden he's being used in a way that he would have told you he doesn't want to be used in. That could be a problem. Same on the defensive end. You bring in a coach that thinks, I want to play AD primarily at the five. AD hates getting beat up by the Marcus Soles and the DeMarcus Cousins of the world, you know, and gets frustrated with that. That's a problem. So do I ask Anthony Davis, hey, what do you think of Kenny Atkinson? No, because he's going to have no clue. But do I ask him about the way he wants to play, interview a coach, see what the coach says to some certain questions, and then and then bounce that off of AD? Yeah, I would do that, but no, of course I wouldn't ask him, who should we hire, this guy or that guy?
Okay. That makes sense.
So, yeah, I think that's a big part of it. What do you think is the timeline for all this? I mean, obviously we have playoffs going on right now. The Pelicans will be somewhat a part of the draft, but probably not a huge part of it. You got free agency coming up with, again, Anthony Davis, his sheet, and then a big decision that needs to be made with Ashik. I'm sure Dell's on the phone with a couple GMs right now, gauging possible trades and, you know, stuff like that. What do you think the timeline looks like, and when would be the latest that you would be comfortable adding a coach?
I think the ideal timeline would be have him on board shortly before the draft. I don't know. Like, it doesn't always happen that way, though. I think you absolutely, like, you did say this, like, the absolute drop-dead date I would probably be comfortable with is a few days short of free agency. Because we don't want another situation where Dell is grabbing players that he hasn't, that he doesn't have a coach who's going to give feedback on whether he wants to use that guy or not. We don't want that situation. And while we can, I mean, it's still Dell's decision about what players he's going to try to bring in and who he's going to go after and what moves he's going to make. It's always best to be able to know, well, this is this guy's philosophies and these are the kind of players he's want. And I'll pass these guys by him when I'm going after them to at least get his take on them. That's what you want to be happening between your GM and your coach. And, you know, the draft isn't as important for us this year. But even if, like, it was, if let's say we were, like, picking in the lottery, I don't know if it matters that much if your coach is on board at that point, because you're just going to take the best talent regardless. And that's all your talent evaluation. But when you're going into free agency and you're building, you're making the final touches on your team, you want that guy available. Now, what sometimes happens and teams end up, you know, hiring coaches later than free agency is usually because they went after one guy and the negotiations drag out or it doesn't work out and then they have to go after another guy. And I'm really hoping that doesn't happen. But that's my take. What's your feel on when they should have a coach in-house? What would be your drop-dead date?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you on the absolute latest. The absolute latest for me would be maybe a week after the finals, or, you know, which is right around draft time. Okay. I don't think the process should take that long unless they're looking at guys still in the playoffs. I mean, it looks like Alvin Gentry will probably, you know, be coaching all the way till the finals. Kenny Atkinson probably, you know, maybe the same. So if those are guys that are high on their list, I could see taking some time. If all of the guys on their list are available, though, and, you know, able to talk to right now, I don't see how it takes more than 2 weeks. I mean, I think it's great to say that they're going to have a very open process and, you know, but this is, I tried to think about this today. This is, if I were to, and I'm going to put you on the spot and I don't even know the answer and I've thought about it. If I had you finish this sentence, this is the best job. Okay. Assuming that, you know, Anthony Davis is going to sign the extension. This is the best job to open up in the NBA since blank.
I'm tempted to say the Clippers job that Doc took when Del Negro was fired, but I could probably go back further to when Dwight Howard, Brian Hill was let go there, and Dwight Howard looked like the next great super big man, and Stan Van came in. So I think that might be the last, I would probably go with that.
Yeah, I think that's a good, I mean.
Yeah. Which is, you know, what, is that 10 years ago now?
Close.
8 years ago, maybe? It's 2009 was the finals, and it took them 2 years to get there, so somewhere around there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even last year, nobody, you know, the coaches who were being looked at did not know that LeBron was coming to Cleveland.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's been a while. God.
Well, I guess Byron Scott did take a job in Cleveland thinking he might have LeBron around.
Yeah, but even then, you weren't attracting free agents there. You didn't have Kyrie.
That's true.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing with the fact that if a coach is available right now and under contract, I think there's a handful of guys you can't get. I think you can't get Krzyzewski, you know, and I mean, obviously you can't get like Popovich, Carlisle, you know, Doc Rivers. I think you could get about 98% of I think you could get almost anybody. This is, you know, a highly coveted job. I've got to imagine that they've got a pretty short list between 3 and 6, maybe. I don't think this is going to be a completely open thing. I don't know why, again, unless some of the guys high on their list are currently coaching, that this takes more than 2 or 3 weeks. So that would be my expected timeline.
Right, and there's also the fact that there is no tampering rules about coaches. Like, you can't talk right now to somebody from the Sacramento Kings about they're going to become a free agent this summer and you'd like them to do that. You know, you might mention it in passing to their agent that, hey, we wondered, you know, we'd like to talk to so-and-so. Or we had an eye on him. He looks pretty good, but you can't, like, have any substantial discussions about players. You can do that about coaches anytime you want to. So I'm willing to bet that the guys on that short list, their agents are already aware they're on that short list. So you're right. It probably won't take that long. Like the only way I could see it dragging out, like I said, was if somehow they went after somebody and that guy decided something else was maybe more attractive and tried to turn it into a bidding war. And then they set the reset button because they're like, screw this. And then they have to go to choice number 2 or choice number 3 or whatever. But then how realistic is that? Like, I mean, I guess, is there any – the last time the Pelicans did this, they went after Thibodeau first, then they went and got Monty after they had a few other names on the board. But Thibodeau got everybody in a bidding war, but it was basically a big market versus a team-owned New Orleans or league-owned New Orleans that wasn't going to pay that much for a coach. So there wasn't even a chance that they're going to compete. Like, I'm 100% convinced that if that situation happened now and Benson and Loomis felt that, you know, Tom Thibodeau was their guy, they would be happy to plunk down the money that he was demanding to come to the team.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Plus, I do believe that Thibodeau would have taken that job if Chris Paul was secured, but everybody knew he was leaving. Meanwhile, he had Rose in the fold for the foreseeable future. All right, so let's just get to it. I think we've got through a lot of the setup stuff. Let's talk about coaches. First thing I want to do is our own little mini rant, set the foundation. What bugs you about coaching narratives as far as people talking about who we should hire and shouldn't hire? I'm not talking about specific names. I'm just talking about narratives when fans talk about looking for or hiring the next coach. Anything that bugs you that you want to get off your chest?
No, actually, I don't have like a little rant here, so I'm interested to hear what you've got to say. Like, I there are people who like seem to swing back and forth on Monty a whole lot, but I don't really have like anything against what people are saying for this. So I'm interested to hear what you're hearing, because maybe people on Twitter are annoying the crap out of you.
Oh no, because this is something that I would have said for years now. This goes across every single sport.
Okay, fire away. What you got?
It's when a person. So we all have preferences. It's human nature. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. But what bothers me to no end is when somebody dismisses a candidate for the type of candidate they are. Oh, they're a college coach? College coaches never work, or they have a low success rate. Or, oh, you know, they're an assistant? Well, they haven't been proven, and Monty was an assistant, and look at how poorly he did. Oh, they're a retread? retreads never were, or whatever, and then they'll point at a guy or two who was a retread. There is absolutely no surefire formula. Coaches who have won in the past and go to a new team, sometimes they fail, sometimes they succeed immensely. Guys who have never been coaches before, sometimes they're terrible, sometimes they're Phil Jackson. Guys who are assistants, same thing. Guys who come from college, same thing. The thing that bugs me the most is this is the type of coach they are, therefore, you know, look at some of the other coaches who came from that same background in the past. They're going to either succeed or fail. Steve Kerr came from TNT. Let's hire Chris Webber then, because that would be an idiotic thing to say. But people do it all the time, and it just does. A prospect is a prospect. It doesn't matter where they came from. His philosophies, his relationships with players, you know, all of that stuff is what's going to matter, not whether he came from college, an assistant bench, you know, a head coach where he was immensely successful, where he immensely Lionel Hollins just went to Brooklyn and did far worse than Jason Kidd did, who had no experience. So, like, that's the thing that bugs me, that I do not want to hear any arguments about. Let's talk about the prospect and the prospect only, not his origin story.
Okay. I can give you one then. And this is just a general pet peeve I have when people are evaluating coaches. And this is just the label thing, kind of what you're going with, where they're just labeling a guy and dismissing him anecdotally. Like, I hate the people who take a coach and say, that guy's not a winner. And you're just kind of like, well, what does that mean? Like, Scotty Brooks has been labeled as not a winner. And the guy went to the NBA Finals. And he, like, they won a game in the NBA Finals. He didn't win the whole championship, but guess what? 29 other teams, including the San Antonio Spurs, didn't win that Finals either. And is Popovich not a winner? Like, the not a winner thing doesn't make any sense to me. Now, as far as I'm concerned, you can pick apart Scotty Brooks if you want to about his X's and O's and his rotations. And there are things that you can actually have discussions about whether you think he should be playing this player instead of that player. And maybe you're wrong and maybe you're right. But saying he's not a winner, how many coaches in the NBA right now have won the entire thing? And does that mean that every other coach sucks?
Yeah, and especially, you know, and this is the thing that Calipari faces too with, well, look at all the talent he has. So if you win it, you were supposed to, and if not, you're just a terrible coach. And, you know, I don't buy that either. It's like you almost get rewarded more for having a bad roster and doing okay. Like, people seem to like Monty more when guys were hurt and he would steal a win here or there, versus when we were completely healthy and only win 6 out of 10 games or something like that, then he was underachieving. So,
well, that's what the coach of the year award generally is, and that's also why those coaches tend to be fired. And it's because they had a team like Hornacek, Jeff Hornacek. Like, just last year, he was the toast of the town. This was the dude who was introducing a fun way of playing basketball. The world's amazing. Hornacek is a great coach. And by the end of this season, people are talking about Hornacek like he was a moron. And what was actually different about that team? They had personnel issues where people couldn't get along with one another. Does that make Hornacek a shitty coach? I don't think so.
Yeah, and it happened. The exact same thing happened with Terry Stotts in Portland. Yes. He was a genius last year. All of a sudden, some injuries hit. Batum is playing terrible, a large part because of injuries. And I'm telling you, I would go on their boards or their site, and same type of critiques we see with Monty. So, you know, it's just this thing where the truth is that we really do not know how to properly evaluate coaches. Like, I could watch LeBron James play, and I know his skill set. Like, it's right there in front of me. And I know who he is and what he needs to work on and what he's amazing at. Coaches, we see so little of their job. And yet we try to evaluate, and when we do evaluate, it's really just based on results. And, you know, based on results, Eric Spoelstra was the best coach in the league the last couple of years, and now all of a sudden he's mediocre. So, you know, it's a hard thing to do, you know, to really evaluate, and it's even harder to project who the coach is going to be. I mean, I definitely have my favorites we'll get to, but you know, to say that I know how it's going to play out, there's just no way that you could say it. So with that, let's move into some of the coaches that, you know, we're talking about, others are talking about. First thing I want to do, though, is, are you familiar with the voir dire process?
No.
So in, you know, when you do jury selection as a lawyer, you get to talk to the potential jury pool, and then you could just eliminate people pretty much for no reason. You only have a certain number of eliminations at your disposal, but you could just eliminate a potential jury member. I want to do that with the head coach candidates.
Okay.
I want you to give me one, maximum of two guys that are not even up for discussion with you that you just want to eliminate right now.
All right, so two people that I absolutely do not want, do they have to be, like, I mean, so I want to narrow the field a little bit. I'm assuming these are guys who do not have jobs or will shortly, could possibly shortly not have a job, like in the case of Tom Thibodeau or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, let's
so
talk.
I'm not like, because I could rip out, you know, Byron Scott really quickly here.
No, I mean, the guys in our bracket, the guys who have been talked about, the guys who are legit possibilities.
Okay, I am not a fan whatsoever of Mark Jackson. And although I think he gets a bad rap, I'm not interested in Mike D'Antoni either.
All right. I mean, my one absolute elimination was Mark Jackson. I mean, I don't even want to discuss the possibility. If he came here, it would be the one guy that I was upset by, and that, you know, that I, you know, whatever's going to happen, you know what's going to happen. If we get the guy we love, we're going to be ecstatic from day one. If we get a guy that we like or we're okay with, you know, within 4 days, a week, 2 weeks, we're going to sell ourselves on him being the greatest choice ever. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just human nature. It's what's going to happen. We both know it.
Yep.
Mark Jackson, it will be impossible for me to sell myself. Absolutely
okay.
Impossible.
Then I'm going to bring a coach in that you're going to have to sell yourself on now. Avery Johnson.
No, he's not a possibility. He just got a coaching job with Alabama. And the funniest thing after Monty was fired is Avery Johnson basically had a quote to the local newspaper that's like, "Don't worry, Alabama fans. I'm not interested in the New Orleans head coach position." Like, he was really a positive, like, you know, we were just going to knock his door down. The most delusional person. I mean, he's lucky to get the Alabama job. Slow down, Avery. But no, he's not a possibility. Now, if he wouldn't have got that Alabama job, he would have been right there on my list with Mark Jackson. But yeah, for me, Mark Jackson's the only one. It'd probably be hard for, you know, similarly to sell myself on D'Antoni. I think there's a lot of coaches out there with his, you know, with similar offensive, you know, I mean, D'Antoni, the analogy I would say is D'Antoni reinvented the wheel, and now other guys have come along and maybe even slightly improved it. So I don't think that I could get really excited about him. If we were to go offense, I would like to take a D'Antoni disciple who, you know, is a little fresher. So, yeah, I think we pretty much got the same guys as far as the ones we veto. So good, we don't have to talk about them. The first guy we got to talk about, I mean, he's, for whatever reason, whether it's legit or it's just, you know, the national media trying to put together what seem like obvious puzzle pieces, is Tom Thibodeau. I mean, is...
They went after him once before.
No, they didn't. Nobody in this organization was in those talks, so it might...
Thank you for saying that.
It might as well be another organization. So we've got him, you know...
His last name is Thibodeau, which is very Cajun feeling.
Yeah, but there's no X on the end, so that's a problem.
That's true.
Anyway, I guess let's start there. It looks like, you know, it at least sounds like, and of course it's the case, that he would love the opportunity. I have no doubt whatsoever that he wants the job. Take me through your thoughts. Let's say we get off this podcast Monday morning. He is announced as the head coach of the team. What are some of your thoughts? Good, bad, another?
I'm happy. Like, I think I really like the idea of Thibodeau being the coach of this team. Like I harp on it all the time. This team's defense sucks. It sucks. They're terrible at defense. They improved to the 22nd best defense this year. They're not average. They're sucky. So Thibodeau, as both head coach and as lead assistant in two different places, has generated teams that are top five consistently, and in some respects better than that until this year with the Bulls, who are, you know, running around with Pau Gasol out there. He has consistently had an amazing defense everywhere he goes. There are a lot of things that people say about him, about how he runs his players into the ground and you know, doesn't care about injuries. But, I mean, I don't actually have any proof that that's the case, really. Like, Derrick Rose, does anybody honestly believe that Tom Thibodeau blew his ACLs out three different times? This guy clearly just has issues with his ACLs. He wasn't even playing heavily when he tore it twice. So there's a lot of stuff there that I don't necessarily buy. Maybe he doesn't trust his young players, but as far as I'm concerned, even those teams that get, like the Celtics, that get put into a really high-powered defense and understand what a high-powered defense, as those teams, like if Thibodeau turns out to only stick around for 3 years, those teams still have the lingering effects. Like the players that were there understand what it takes to be a good defense, and they linger on as really good defenses, whether he's there or not. So if he ended up being it, I'm perfectly happy with that. We're going to get a foundation of a really good defense for this team, and whether he's the right answer for you know, in the next 3 or 4 years, perfectly, maybe not, but at least we're going to have a pretty good defense, and their offense hasn't ever been terrible. So that's my take.
Would
you be upset if Thibodeau rolled in next week?
Upset? No, like I said, the only guy who would upset me is Mark Jackson. But okay, so let me ask you a couple questions first. One, would you say that of the available options, Tom Thibodeau has the highest floor and is probably the lowest risk?
Yes. I would actually put Jeff Van Gundy in about that same area.
Even though he hasn't coached in, when did he finish? Like 2007?
He was with Houston. Yeah, I think it's 2007. No, I would still go with Jeff. I think Jeff Van Gundy's proven that he's a pretty solid defensive coach who can create any sort of coaching scheme around. I mean, like that, he turned a team that had Tracy McGrady, who didn't really ever care much about defense, and probably the most immobile center of all time. Maybe that's unfair. A very immobile center in Yao Ming. That team was like consistently a really good defensive team. So
yeah,
I would probably put Jeff pretty like right there with Tom. I might say the same. No, I wouldn't say that about Alvin Gentry. I could see this floor being lower. So
who do you think is more mobile, Yao Ming or the chair that Yijian Lin played against?
Probably the chair. I'm just going to bring this up because my favorite rookie moment of Chris Paul involved Yao Ming, so I always got to mention it whenever I talk about Yao Ming. There is a moment And this is the moment when I realized that Chris Paul playing basketball was a dick. And it was, he got a rebound, he's dribbling down the court, Yao Ming is basically running down, switching sides, not really paying attention necessarily, but, you know, he lumbered, so it would take him a while to get up to speed, and Chris Paul's surveying the floor, and he glances over his shoulder and sees Yao Ming starting down the floor, and he basically leaps sideways and just comes to a dead halt. And as soon as Yao Ming plows into him, he does like this little roll, comes up, and he's still dribbling the basketball. And Yao Ming goes down like a poleaxed cow, just smack down on the ground. And he gets called for a foul. Yao Ming does. And he's so slow to get up, you could just tell it hurt him like hell. And that was like one of my, I loved that moment. Like, it was like the first moment I realized Chris Paul was a dick.
Well, all right. I mean, Van Gundy's interesting. I mean, obviously, you know, he was somebody that Thibodeau worked for. So, you know, he's kind of, I made the comparison today that, you know, Van Gundy's kind of the Socrates to Thibodeau's being Plato. So, you know, do you want the teacher or the student? But
so who's Aristotle then?
I mean, I guess it would have to be maybe Sean Miller, who's another guy I think we'll talk about. But I agree. I think he has the highest floor. You know, there's also the positive in that he worked with Anthony Davis at Team USA. They're somewhat familiar. You would think that, you know, if Dell went to AD and said, what do you think of him? That, you know, at least that's one, maybe the only coach in this whole search that AD has some experience with. Here's my issues. And I'm not going to get into the lazy narratives, because I actually do my research, and, you know, I don't just go for the narratives, and I would encourage other people to do the same. You know, the running the players into the ground, at least game minutes, outside of Luol Deng and maybe Jimmy Butler this year, that is absolutely not true. He does not, you know, nobody else has had above average minutes in his tenure. What I don't like is something that I said earlier. The Chicago Bulls over the last 5 years have had the slowest average pace in the NBA. I just can't do it. It doesn't make sense to me with Anthony Davis. It's something that I can't do. And, you know, I've made the mistake of going, well, yeah, that was Monty's tendency and what they believed in Portland, but maybe he'll change. Oh, maybe he'll change when he gets a new roster. The coach isn't going to change. And even if it does, it'll be incremental. Like, I think 1 year, the New Orleans was 23rd under Monty instead of 27th or 29th. So I can't do that. The other thing, you know, if you listen to the Low Post this morning with Arnovitz and Zach Lowe, and there's too many of these stories from people in the know in the NBA of just – of the fact that, you know, Thibodeau's kind of a robot. He is all basketball all the time. And it's not so much the physical wear and tear, it's the mental that he puts on players. And that, yeah, I agree that.
Kind of like Scott Skiles.
Yeah, and he will teach them things that they don't know right now. But the chance of him lasting 12 to 15 years somewhere just seems incredibly low. And I love the fact that he has a high floor, but I guess if I'm going to go, I'm going to go big, and I'm going to go for the possible dynasty. To me, you know, I don't know if I want to go for the safe, if I want to go for the, you know, if you told me this team will win 55 games every year for the next 5 years and, you know, maybe get to the Western Conference Finals once or twice and take your chances from there, you know, that would be great. Don't get me wrong. I mean, that's something this franchise hasn't had, and I've been watching since 1993, but, you know, it just wouldn't be enough for me. I really want to go for the home run. I want to go for the dynasty. I want to go for the Phil Jackson to Michael Jordan. I want to go for the, you know, the Popovich to you know, AD's Tim Duncan. I want to go for the Belichick and the Brady. I want to take that chance. I don't want to take the safe. And the last thing I'll say is, and I really do not want this to come off as a race thing or solely a race thing. When I think about Anthony Davis and him getting excited about a coach and wanting to work with him for the next 10 years, I don't think of a white man with no personality in his mid to late 50s who, you know, grinds players mentally and, you know, wears them out in that capacity. And I'm not saying that he absolutely has to be best friends or love his coach, but, you know, you see some of the relationships, you see the way Curry has clicked with Kerr, you see some of the other guys around the league, and it's really hard for me to envision Anthony Davis having that long-term relationship with him, and I would rather give it a shot. And again, I'm not turning this into a race thing. I'm not saying the next guy has to be black, but I think he does have to be younger and be in touch with the younger generation, which, again, by all accounts, it doesn't sound like Tibbs is really there, and or I think he's got to have, you know, some kind of personality that, you know, connects with that generation. All those things combined, I wouldn't be upset at all. But for me, I want to swing for the home run. And I think the home run means some coach in his mid-40s, late-40s at the latest, can relate to young players, you know, and could grow with AD over the next 10, 15 years. So I don't think it'd be the worst thing in the world, but it wouldn't be close to my ideal option.
Okay. Then let me throw somebody out there, and you can tell me the technical reasons why this is a bad idea, because I still have actually gotten a couple questions about why he's not even in our head coach tournament. If you're talking about guys who can relate to to young basketball players, isn't John Calipari at the top of the list? So why are we not even talking about him?
I mean, two reasons. One, the day that that Monty Williams was fired, he agreed to yet another contract extension. So practically, I don't think it's going to happen. And two, if Dell Demps is truly leading the search, there is no way he will want to hire Calipari, because Calipari, according to previous negotiations, will want to be president. You know, and people who want to be coach and president also want to hire their own GM. So it's strictly logistic. I think it has no chance of happening for those two reasons.
Okay. Now let's say we took all that off the board. Let's say Loomis just walks to Kentucky. I don't know why he would do that, because he probably can afford a car at least. But he walks to Kentucky, goes into Calipari's office, sits down and says, $100 million a year. And then taps his fingers together like Mr. Burns. And so Calipari is now our coach, because there's no way in hell he's turning that down. Would you be happy with Calipari? Would you think Calipari is the type of guy that you just described, the home run possibility?
I he would be – right now I have a pretty short list. He would be around 3 or 4 on my list. He would definitely not be something I would be upset about. Like I've said before, he would be entirely dependent on – the assistants that he hired, and then I would make my true evaluation. If he surrounds himself with veteran coaches, you know, guys who are good X and O guys, if he does what Steve Kerr did, you know, I would be more than happy, because I trust Calipari, you know, in game preparation, in practice. I trust him to be able to recruit, you know, talent over to our team. If he surrounded himself with a good coaching staff, I think he could be the home run guy. But again, I don't think it has any chance of happening for the two reasons I said.
Okay. Let me just cut right to the chase. You seem to have a list of your top four guys. Do you want to share your top four guys, or I have basically one guy at the top of my list. And everybody else is just kind of,
I either don't know enough about yet, which, you know, that's my own fault. I'll be looking at them more, and or I'll be reading our Bourbon Street Shots Coaches Tournament, so everybody should be reading that as it comes out over the next few days as we make the case for each guy. So I'm sure that'll help me get more informed about some of these guys. But do you have your top list already?
Yeah, my boss didn't send me on a stupid, you know, business trip. Like, how do you send out the co-host of the number one Pelicans podcast when a coach gets fired? Like, that's just a terrible business decision.
It was.
So, yes, I have been – first of all, I've been prepping for this for a while. You know, we even discussed back in February the chance that Monty gets fired. I think – this has always been in the cards. It's always been a matter of when, not if. So, you know, I've been studying a lot of these guys for a long time. Yeah, my list is pretty clear. I've got a top tier that I've got a number one that I would be very excited by, a couple more after that I would be excited by, and then a bunch that I could sell myself on. The number one, clear in a way, I mean, you and I were on a podcast in which I said before the Hornets got the number one pick that Anthony Davis would be one of the top 15 players of all time. You scoffed at me. No, we had a laugh. There is a coach right now who I feel as comfortable saying he will be a good NBA coach as I did saying Anthony Davis would be a good, great NBA player. And that's Fred Hoiberg. He has a heart condition. But take out the medical. If and when Fred Hoiberg becomes an NBA coach, if he does not become one of the great NBA coaches in the league, I will be as surprised as if Anthony Davis did not become one of the great players in the league. That's how confident I am that Fred Hoiberg will be a fantastic coach. I've been watching him for about 16, 18 months now. I love everything he does. Any interview that's ever been done with him or his players, I eat up. I've been minorly stalking this guy now for about a year and a half, and I've been looking for flaws, and there's some things on the defensive end that aren't great, but if this guy doesn't become the next great NBA coach, if he doesn't, you know, have an early career the way that Steve Kerr has, or you know, somebody like that, I'll just be absolutely shocked. I don't see, you know, an issue with him whatsoever. I mean, he checks off nearly every single box.
Sounds like you got a real man crush there.
Yeah, I mean, I like what I like, and I mean, he's done it with, you're talking about what he's done at Iowa State, which he's made I'd say conservatively a top 10 program over the last couple of years. He's done it with no NBA. I mean, not one of his guys have become or will, you know, even the guys he currently has, an NBA rotation player. Not even a rotation player, not a ninth guy, like nothing. And he's, you know, produced results. He's had amazing offenses. I mean, his principles are so modern age. Plus, he gets the guys to buy in, play with energy. He's obviously an ex-NBA player, ex-NBA executive, like understands the game from, you know, a multitude of areas. So to me, he's the guy. After that, there's a couple guys that would get me excited. You know, Messina, who I've said, I mean, a EuroLeague coach and kind of a god over there who's now a San Antonio Spurs assistant. My one worry with him is, like I said, I think he would want to make Anthony Davis primarily a post player, and I don't know how Anthony feels about that, although I would personally love that. So if he could get AD to buy in, you know, that would be killing two birds with one stone. You know, Sean Miller, coach at Arizona, is a guy that I love too. I mean, if you're talking about the next Thibodeau, you're talking about Sean Miller, but with some creative offensive principles. Like what I wrote in a piece that's coming out soon is you're talking about a guy who basically has his teams play Memphis Grizzly defense with LA Clippers or Houston Rockets offense. I mean, their defense was phenomenal. Top in defensive rebound percentage this past year, you know, towards the top in steals. And then on the other end, they led the nation in free throw attempts. So, you know, we're talking about teams play really physical, really tough. If you want to talk about eliminating teams scoring in our paint, grabbing offensive rebounds against us, and, you know, guys going up soft, you hire Sean Miller. And then the last one is an NBA guy and somebody I know very few know, Kenny Atkinson from Atlanta. For those who know the podcast, they know that my best friend works for the Hawks, you know, has been working with Atkinson for a couple of years. I'll give you the scouting report from his mouth. Great player development, European influence, loves up-tempo. Big selling point for me here, will make any, and he stresses any, point guard better. He is the guy responsible for Linsanity. He has made Teague a lot better. Schroeder has, you know, taken a huge leap. He is the guy in Atlanta and before that in New York that was responsible for point guard development. Heavy pick and roll guy, you know, good X and O guy, will encourage 3-point shooting. Players love him. So these are the words from somebody who's worked with him for the last 2 years. You know, on top of that, Arnovitz wrote a good article about him. So I just think that if you're looking at the next possible great assistant that could come in and have a, you know, a Budenholzer type of influence and take a team to the next level, it would be Kenny Atkinson. So those are some of the guys. I don't know how familiar you were with any of them. Who were you most sold on just by my quick bios on all of them?
Sean Miller.
Okay.
Sounds like if Kevin McHale loses his job, like he sounded like that'd be his, what's his name? Daryl Morey's dream coach is kind of what you described there.
He doesn't emphasize the 3-point shot as much as I think Houston would like, but you know, Jeff Van Gundy said in an interview once that there was only two people he ever met that he knew from the start were destined to be NBA head coaches. One was Eric Spoelstra and the other was Sean Miller. So it comes from that background. I mean, I would say the one thing is, you know, doesn't greatly emphasize the 3-point shot, actually likes a little bit of post basketball, runs a lot of motion stuff, has a lot of nice plays, but I would say that's the one thing that might scare a couple people off is that he loves getting to the rim. Like I said, led the nation in free throws, but you know, not heavy, heavy 3-point shooting.
Okay. Well, partly because I'm not super familiar with college game and I don't have a best friend who works for the Atlanta Hawks. None of those three guys were my number one dude. And actually I guess number four guys, cause you also mentioned Messina. So my number one guy is Mike Malone, the former assistant coach of the New Orleans Pelicans. And I, the whole reason why I like Mike Malone is if you'll remember the last time the Pelicans actually had, or slash Hornets, had a actually good defense, Mike Malone was here running it. And then he went to Golden State and became an associate head coach next to Mark Jackson. That team actually made its first big leap under the two of them, but there was no insanity coming out of Golden State during that season where the two of them were there. And then Malone was hired away by Sacramento, and suddenly Mark Jackson went on the crazy train, and everything kind of went weird. The team still continued to improve, but if you'll remember, Steve Kerr came in and basically said, the defense is good here. I'm just going to fix the offense. And do you know what Mike Malone's specialty is? It's his defense. So I'm pretty willing to give Mike Malone more of the credit for that defense than Mark Jackson. And then he went to Sacramento. And when was the last time you saw Sacramento playing good basketball and DeMarcus Cousins not to be, you know, half disinterested almost most of the game? It was under Mike Malone. He reached DeMarcus Cousins. He got somehow past that veneer of disinterest and uncaring and just pettiness and cracked in there and got that guy to buy in to playing serious basketball. And while there might be a Mike Malone, Tyreek Evans headbutting thing going on that I should probably be worried about, and there's also probably some contract issues because he's still probably under contract with the Sacramento Kings and we might have to give compensation or have something going on there to be able to bring him in. Mike Malone is my dude. Like I said before, I want defense, and he has already proven he can be defense. I think he was showing earlier this season with Sacramento he can kind of make chicken salad out of chicken, you know what? And I think he deserves a chance with a really good team base to see what he could do.
So again, he's in the middle of my pack on a, you know, I wouldn't be upset and I probably could even eventually sell myself on. I like the age again. I think that he's somebody that could grow for the next 10, 12 years. Here's a couple of my issues. And I said it earlier. I want to see if you agree with me. I mean, you told the whole Mike Malone story. And the fact is that Mike Malone did change a couple of teams, but first as an assistant. Mm-hmm. Tom Thibodeau was an assistant. You know, you look around the league, doesn't it seem very possible based on past precedent that you can get an offensive-minded coach and then get a great defensive coach to be your defensive coordinator in essence and your lead assistant? Don't you think it's much easier to find that than the other way around?
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that. Like, I mean, what did Golden State do this year? They had an awesome defense. They brought in Steve Kerr to be the front man, the guy who pulls everything together, and then they brought in Alvin Gentry to be their offensive-minded coach. Rick Carlisle was the offensive guy for Larry Bird and the Pacers. Like Bird always said, like X's and O's offensively, it was all Carlisle. I never did a thing. I think you can find offensive guys who are offensive talents and have them be assistant coaches as well. And I think you're also, you're kind of saying that about Mike Malone with the idea that Mike Malone doesn't have much in the way of an offensive repertoire. But while he builds his reputation on defense, Sacramento, when it was actually playing well, had a pretty sweet offense running. And they were running it through a big man. So, I can understand where you're going. I think that you're probably right in that there are more assistant coaches who have built their reputation on installing good defenses than there are ones who've done the opposite.
And I don't want to take away from Malone because, again, my friend did work for Cleveland when Malone was there. He came over to Atlanta with Danny Ferry. And he said that, you know, it was often Malone who was actually drawing up the offensive plays in that time. So I think he does have it on both ends. My other question, again, I think that people listening to this podcast could say that the glaring difference between you and I is – it seems like I'm willing to strike out for the home run. Do you think that there is a chance that Mike Malone is the home run? And by home run, I'm talking about, does he have any chance of being a Popovich, a Phil Jackson, a Carlisle, even a Doc Rivers? Is there any chance that he ever gets into kind of that, even a Spoelstra, he ever gets into that echelon?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I believe that. I mean, I have – so let me put it this way. And the way you're, like, describing people like Fred Hoiberg and Kenny Atkinson is you've seen or have enough information that you see moments of brilliance and genius in those guys that they're showing you something that you can, like, stake – well, that's the high I've seen. And you probably haven't seen that from Mike Malone. So you don't have the ability to peg it that high because you haven't seen his brilliance. But I actually feel like I've seen that brilliance in action defensively, where he's obviously led a team at such a high level that I can happily peg, like, defense. He could be the Tom Thibodeau of defense, and he's not a robot, like you're saying. You're not going to hear his voice grating nonstop on players because he can obviously reach players. He's done it before. I'm comfortable with being able to say Mike Malone could become that guy. And while he hasn't done it yet in any situation he's only actually been in charge one time. And can you really hold being in Sacramento and dealing with that particular situation against a dude? I mean, I think he did pretty well for what he had to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have to be that sold on Malone. I'm actually tackling him for our bracket, and I've done some research. There was a great 538 article on just the pure numbers saying that there's no justification for him being fired and that it was an anomaly of sorts. He would be in my middle. I mean, honestly, I would feel it's close between him and Thibodeau. Like, okay. And the only reason I might go Thibodeau, and this is, I think, the last thing we definitely got to hit on, is we keep talking about head coach, head coach, head coach, head coach. I think you could argue that the assistants and staff could be as important, if not more of important of a change than the head coach. I think that there is a decent, if not good chance that the upgrade from Randy Ayers to whoever the lead assistant is going to be better than the upgrade from Monty to whoever the head coach is. And, you know, I don't want to put Randy Ayers out and just completely bash him, but let's just say I'm not a fan at all. But you look at the great coaches, like I was studying Van Gundy today. Go look at his staff from his Houston days. I mean, he had Steve Clifford. He had, he had obviously Thibodeau. Like, he had an amazing staff. He had a guy, I'm blanking on his name now, but has had a good career, is the D-League coach of the Utah Jets. Like, his staff was impressive. We keep talking about the head coach. It's going to be a full, you know, it's going to be all of it with who the assistants are. That's part of my concern with somebody like Malone. Some of these college coaches not named Hoiberg who don't really have the professional connections is how do these guys fill out their staff? You know, Thibodeau, I would be far more on board if he goes gets an elite assistant. I mean, imagine if Thibodeau goes and says, hey, Kenny Atkinson, how would you like a 200% raise and you could be my lead assistant here in New Orleans, you know, and get a chance to shine. I mean, maybe that's right. A possibility. I get the best of both worlds. So I think, you know.
And you're right, because Mike Malone probably doesn't have the stature in the NBA right now to be able to go to guys who also feel they should be in line for head coaching, like Kenny Atkinson probably does, and bring them on board. Like, that's one of the things, like, you can say for Steve Kerr, like, he got Alvin Gentry to come and be his lead coach, and you say the same stuff about Doc Rivers. And, like, there are guys who have the stature where they can go to people who are former head coaches or guys who feel they should be head coaches and still get them to come and work for them, and that's saying something.
Yeah, and I mean, it goes both ways, because sometimes the really great assistant coaches like going somewhere with a non-established guy. Like, Mike Malone came to New Orleans because he knew he would have more power with Monty Williams, a first-time coach, you know, and it's the same thing. I mean, Alvin Gentry knew that he would probably have more say with a guy like Steve Kerr, who was a first-time head coach. So, even some of these college guys, I think assistants might go, all right, I'll get a little bit more power, you know, with a first-time head coach, and my voice will have a little bit more power in the room. So we keep evaluating the head coaches. To me, I would really like to know, and that's something that Dell's going to know sitting in that room, is he's going to ask guys, all right, what's your staff going to look like? And he's going to have access to that information that I don't right now. Will Sean Miller be able to put together, you know, a great staff or not? Because to me, I would take Miller in a vacuum over Thibodeau, But if Thibodeau could put together a much better assistant staff, you know, then all of a sudden that swings it that way. What kind of staff could Van Gundy put together who, you know, I have heard from multiple people now who have said that he is interested in the job and even very interested. So, you know, that's something that we can't, you know, fully know. And the last thing I want to get your opinion on is, again, I heard us talking about this in the podcast from the last time, is we were pretty much both on the it's probably going to be a run it back type of thing. Now that we've come to the point where we're going to have a new coach, like you said, you don't believe that Ashiq was a Del Demps ideal situation. How likely do you see it now that there's major or possibly multiple, you know, major roster changes this summer?
I think it became infinitely more likely that this is not going to be a run it back situation. And I think, like, my rough, and it was probably obvious from earlier, I think Ashiq is the one who is the most likely to be impacted by that. Like, this team is probably going to be more likely to not bring back Ashiq if they go the route of what I think Dell is trying to build offensively and defensively. I think Ashiq was the Monty, this is what you want, so I'm going to go get it for you. And I don't think that's necessarily what he wants. Now, if he brings in a coach and that coach says, Ashiq is the ideal guy to fit my system, like, you could easily see Thibodeau saying this, because he loved Ashiq when he was there in Chicago. And if that guy comes in and says, you know, Ashiq is a key part, I could play him, you know, situationally, you know, easily 26 minutes a game on normal, I think he's absolutely worth it and you can keep him. But I don't think that's necessarily the coach he'll be heading for. So I think that it's more likely that certain people will move. And like I mentioned also before with like Mike Malone butted heads with Tyreek Evans. There's a reason why Tyreek Evans wasn't in Sacramento anymore. So if Mike Malone is their choice, is Tyreek Evans going to have to be out the door? That's a possibility as well. So I think it becomes more likely. And that's just the case with any sort of change. Like, we could say Dell made this team, but Dell made this team trying to work with someone, and he working with somebody else that might come up with an entirely different structure. Do you think it's more or less likely that we're going to run it back?
I mean, I agree with exactly what you said. Infinitely less likely. But I'm not ready to put any guy more likely on the block than the other. Like, to me, yeah, Thibodeau comes in, I think Ashiq stays, and I think Ryan Anderson and probably even Eric Gordon, they're looking to move immediately and, you know, get whatever they can and get totally different types of guys in. Meanwhile, somebody like Hoiberg will make – I mean, Ryan Anderson could be an all-star in Fred Hoiberg's offense, and Amir Ashiq would have absolutely no use for him. You know, it would be like, for a football analogy, it would be like giving a coach a fullback in a run and shoot offense. Like, he would literally probably never get on the court with Fred Hoiberg's philosophy. So I don't know who, but to me, there's very few candidates out there where I say, okay, that coach would look at our roster and go, I'd like to give it a try and run it back with these guys. I don't see that, and I see pretty polar options. I see a couple defensive guys, like we say with Thibodeau, Sean Miller, you know, Van Gundy, and then I see guys who are pace and space, you know, and then you're going a whole different direction. So I think that the odds have become infinitely more possible that we see at least one major move this summer, and I'm curious as to what it'll be.
Yeah, and honestly, just getting rid of Monty Williams is just, if anybody feels like Del Demps is ever satisfied, like, there has never been any indication to me that Del Demps wouldn't move anybody on this roster not named Anthony Davis, whether coach or player, if he thought it would help this team at all. I don't feel like Dell Demps has any sort of sentimental attachment to people. Like Ryan Anderson, there is a monster sentimental attachment there between him and the coaching staff. And anybody who tells you different is just fooling themselves. But I'm 100% willing to bet that that sentimental attachment does not exist between Dell Demps and Ryan Anderson. And if Dell can see Ryan Anderson moving for something that'll help him, he'll be out the door regardless of his story.
Yeah, and the other thing is the continuity stuff. Like, again, if you listen to the Low Arnovitz podcast today, they talk about how players say it takes about a half a year to really pick up Thibodeau's defensive system. The players are just, it takes them a while. It's a lot of very set rules. It's being realized, whatever. And, you know, this is the same thing where if Monty comes back, you can argue, okay, Tyreek's finally starting to understand the defensive principles. He's learning the offensive playbook. You know, he has more value than maybe somebody as good or slightly better who is going to have to learn the whole system all over again. Everybody's going to have to learn the system from scratch. So now you don't have that argument anymore of, you know, this guy is already acclimated with the system, so it would actually have us take a step back to bring in somebody who's slightly better. So I think for that reason, you know, it's something to where I think you're right. They're just going to look at what's right for this new coach. Hopefully Dell and the new coach are 100% eye-to-eye on the new philosophy, which is another reason that, you know, Thibodeau never made sense. He doesn't make sense for me. Like, I don't understand why if Dell got his choice that he would pick a guy with pretty seemingly different philosophies. So, you know, hopefully they'll be on the same page. And from there, you know, the roster will be constructed with the coach in mind and the GM's beliefs in mind. I think it'll be really, really interesting. I can't wait to see which way it goes. My last question, gun to your head. People are going to want to know this. Obviously, we have no clue. We are on the podcast. We are discussing the new head coach of the Pelicans in a couple of weeks. Who will that gentleman be?
Sean Miller.
Wow. All right. I guess I am going to go with, it's going to maybe take a little while, but wow, I really don't know where to go here. I'm going to go with Kenny Atkinson.
Okay. Did I take your guy? Were you going to say Sean Miller?
No, I find it curious because you said at the beginning of the podcast you think Dell's going to go offensive. So,
yeah.
But I think you said what you, a combination of what you think Dell's going to do combined with what you want on the defensive end. So
it's possible I might be doing wishful thinking.
yeah, so we're going to have our tournament on the site. A lot of good information about all these guys. Whether it's on our site or somewhere else, I would really encourage people to do their research. Don't be lazy. Listen to the narratives. Root for the guy that you've already heard of to be coach. Really look into all these people with an open mind. Then, of course, when we hire whoever we do, we'll give you the full bio on the guy and what to expect as far as roster construction moving forward. But it's an exciting time in the franchise, and you know, this is one of those moments where if they hire the right guy, it sets us up for decades, and if they hire the wrong one, AD could be out the door, you know, sooner rather than later. So I would say this is probably the most pivotal point in the franchise since those lotto balls popped up in 2012.
That's true. I have one question for you. Do you think Tim Floyd might be available anywhere?
Oh, God. It's really making me use up all my voix dires. No, but the last thing I will ask, and I promise is the last thing. I know I said last thing today. Is there, when you hear fans and the Twitterverse and experts, make fun of coaches. Does it or does it not seem to you that there's a common denominator? And the reason I'm asking this is because I think that we just can't afford the strikeout. I think the double even in this situation would be fine. Doesn't it seem like there's a common denominator to you of the bad coaches that would be pretty simple to avoid? Or do you think that it's just that they're all over the place?
No, I think they'd be pretty easy to avoid.
And what are the attributes that usually comprise the quote-unquote bad coaches?
Towering egotism and bombast.
And, I mean, what about strategy?
The
long two. I mean, like, we make fun of – who do we make fun of? Randy Whitman, Byron Scott, Monty Williams. Who are the other NBA coaches that people just make fun of?
Oh, David Blatt is getting murdered right now.
Okay, for maybe a slightly different reason. But, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's mostly the living in the 90s, you know, type of offensive philosophy. I think it's pretty easy to avoid the strikeout. That's just me.
Yeah. And honestly, the living in the 90s thing is the one thing that worries me about Jeff Van Gundy a little bit. I feel like sometimes with the way he's talking on the TNT broadcast, that maybe he's a little bit stuck there.
Yeah, same with Lowe's podcast. I love a lot of the things he says, but the game has moved forward. It's not going back, and I don't think he's accepted a lot of the New Age philosophies.
Yeah. So, anyways, got anything else to talk about?
That is it. We will we'll have the tournament on the site. We'll have a podcast talking in depth about the next guy. And, stay tuned. Going to be an exciting couple of weeks.
Yep. So thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know.